From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the latest on breast cancer detection and treatment. We talk with Dr. Susan Love, director of the UCLA Breast Center. There's a new updated edition of Dr. Susan Love's breast book. It's been called the Bible of Women with Breast Cancer. Also today, the man-eating tigers of Bengal. We talk with Cy Montgomery, who studied the tigers and the beliefs that surround them. And world music critic Milo Miles reviews a new collection of Arab pop music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. French President Jacques Chirac says his country will resume nuclear testing in the South Pacific. The announcement comes on the eve of his visit to the United States. Washington and Russia both have testing bans, and both are strongly urging France to do the same. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
In a press conference on television, President Jacques Chirac said he's decided to carry out 8 tests. He said France would start testing in September and finish by May next year at the latest. Chirac justified the decision, saying France needs to ensure the reliability and safety of its nuclear arsenal and to be able to develop the technology to carry out simulated tests on computers. Chirac insisted the tests are safe and pose no environmental threat, but that view is not shared by Australia, New Zealand, and other countries in the South Pacific. The United States is also against a resumption of French testing. The topic could cause friction between Chirac and U.S. President Bill Clinton when they hold their first summit in Washington on Wednesday. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
President Clinton will talk to the country in a nationally broadcast address this evening. He's going to speak about his view that the country's budget can be balanced in about 10 years. Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin says Mr. Clinton worked on the budget process for a long time.
He was committed to addressing this in an exceedingly thoughtful fashion and to look at everything that was relevant to how our economy performs and then to put together his budget when he had completed his review. And that's what he's done now. And I think when you listen to him tonight, what you will hear is a man addressing in an exceedingly thoughtful fashion the requisites for continued economic growth in this country.
The president's remarks will be at 9 Eastern time this evening. The government says consumer prices rose 0.3% last month. The core rate of inflation, which drops volatile food and energy prices, was up by a smaller 0.2%. That's the smallest increase since December. Analyst Nancy Kimmelman says today's figures are more evidence the Federal Reserve could think about cutting short-term interest rates.
Together with the retail sales numbers that were reported this morning, I think we're building the case for a more accommodative stance from the Fed. We're not there yet. We've had a couple of months of weak numbers for the Fed to act and move to lower rates. I think we'd need to see another month of weak employment data.
The president's remarks will be at 9, or excuse me, the government says retail sales moved up 0.2% in May, much lower than the 0.6% rise expected by economists. The son of evangelist Billy Graham says a dangerous loss of blood caused his father to faint last week. Franklin Graham told the Charlotte Observer that his father lost about a third of his blood. The elder Graham is back at a Toronto hospital for testing today, 1 week after he was admitted for treatment for a bleeding colon. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 34 points. This is NPR. The much-beleaguered government of Japan's Prime Minister Tomiichi Murayama survived a vote of no confidence today. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
The hastily called no-confidence measure was brought up just 1 day before Prime Minister Murayama was due to depart for the G7 summit in Halifax. There he is expected to confer privately with President Clinton on a stubborn auto dispute that is threatening to sour U.S.-Japan relations in a year many had hoped would bring better ties between the two countries 50 years after World War II. With Japan's economy suffering and few reforms to fix it, the opposition said Murayama's government had proven it was unfit to rule. But surviving the vote was never really in doubt because the ruling parties control Parliament. It is nonetheless an embarrassment for the Prime Minister, who is plunging in the polls and who must now face fellow leaders of the world's most industrialized nations more humbled than even his usual modest demeanor demands. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
The FBI is asking for help in searching for a homemade trailer and plastic barrels that could have been used in the Oklahoma City bombing. The agency has set up a national toll-free hotline to receive tips. A spokesman says the trailer in question may have been seen in Kansas last October or November. New studies suggest violence in America might not be as widespread as earlier studies suggested. Reports in the Journal of the American Medical Association cite a study of Denver women who received emergency room treatment in 1992 and 93. It found about 10% of them sought treatment for injuries from domestic violence. Previous estimates had ranges as high as 33%. The Denver study says the higher estimates are based on a misinterpretation of past research. A second study looks at firearms injuries in the U.S. The CDC says 99,000 Americans got emergency room treatment for gunshot wounds, much lower than first thought. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most popular reference books about breast cancer has just been updated. My guest is the author, Dr. Susan Love. She's a surgeon and an activist. She directs the UCLA Breast Center, and she co-founded the National Breast Cancer Coalition. When she became a surgeon in 1980, there were almost no women doctors working with breast cancer patients. She was the first female general surgeon at the hospital in Boston where she first practiced. Perhaps her perspective as a woman explains why she has differed from the medical establishment in some of her opinions and recommendations. Dr. Susan Love's breast book was first published in 1990. In the new edition, she questions the importance of breast self-exams.
Breast self-exam is really wishful thinking. We wish that breast self-exam would work in terms of early detection and in terms of catching breast cancer at a different stage, but it really doesn't work very well. And that would be okay, except that it scares women to death, and I think it distracts us from moving forward into something that really does work.
Why doesn't it work?
It doesn't work because the notion of early detection, in fact, isn't entirely right. We've sold it as if every cancer goes from a grain of sand to a BB to a pea to a grape to a lemon to a grapefruit. You know, and if you just do your breast self-exam, you can find it when it's a grain of sand and life will be great. The problem is what you're feeling when you feel a cancer are not the cancer cells. It's the reaction they incite around them. And until it's a certain size, you're not going to feel that. So in some people, the cancer shows up as a grape, and it never was a grain of sand or a pea. And in some people, it shows up as a grapefruit. And this notion that if you just examined yourself, you would find it at a smaller size just isn't true. It just wasn't a smaller size. Some people are lucky, and they do have lumps that are found very early, but not in general.
Well, how are most lumps discovered?
Well, most women do find their own lumps, but they don't find them doing breast self-exam. They find them in the shower, they're rolling over in bed, their lover finds it. It's not because they stood in front of the mirror and did a whole song and dance, because most women, in fact, don't do it. They're too scared. It's too scary. And it really sort of, I think it alienates women from their bodies. Instead of thinking of your breast as a nice, friendly part of you, it becomes the enemy, and your job is to find the hidden landmine that's, you know, going to do you in.
But you don't think you even stand a big chance of discovering a lump sooner with a breast self-exam than you would if you were just waiting for discovering it haphazardly in the shower or while making out?
Maybe a little bit, but not that much. I think that, you know, breast self-exam was really invented back in a time when women didn't touch themselves down there, and down there was below the chin, you know. The notion is to touch your body, and I think nowadays many more women, you know, women are more aware of it, and they do that. But they're too scared to, they feel like they have to do this whole thing and really catalog every grain of sand and, you know, really go on a search and destroy mission. And I think that really isn't necessary.
Dr. Susan Love is my guest. Do you think I'm going to get a lot of phone calls after this broadcast from gynecologists saying that what you have just said is irresponsible?
No, I don't. But I think that there are some women who found their cancers doing breast self-exam are the ones who get upset. and feel like if they found theirs that way, then we shouldn't be disregarding it. And the problem is not so much, I mean, I don't think it's evil for people to do breast self-exam. I just think we shouldn't be putting so much money and effort into it. We should be putting the money into really finding a really good way of early detection, maybe a blood test or something like that.
Women who have, you know, what is often described as lumpy breasts are often told they have fibrocystic disease.
Right.
Which you say is not really a disease.
It's not a disease at all. It's really a garbage term that we use to cover anything going on in the breast that isn't cancer. So lumps, pain, swelling, discharge, anything that's going on where the physician or the healthcare provider doesn't think it's cancer, they'll say, don't worry, dear, it's fibrocystic disease. And this makes the doctor or the provider feel better because they have something to write in the insurance form. And it makes the patient feel worse because now she has a disease. It's actually no more a disease than menstrual cramps are a disease or hot flashes are a disease. It's part of the normal response of the breast to hormonal cycling. And you don't have to do anything about it. What happens is once you label it a disease, then the patient wants a treatment. And we don't have any treatment, really. And so then the doctor says something like, stop drinking coffee, which in fact has been shown not to have any difference, make any difference in benign breast problems. But they hope maybe it'll have a placebo effect. Maybe the patient will feel better anyway. And so you get on this path by calling it a disease that's really erroneous.
Well, haven't a lot of women been told by their doctors that if they have fibrocystic disease, they're more likely to develop breast cancer in the future?
Well, that was thought. And in fact, my first paper in this field, which I hate to say is now almost 20 years ago, was about that and was writing how fibrocystic disease, quote unquote, does not increase your risk of cancer at all. And I didn't get any critiques from anybody. I mean, the gynecologist didn't call me on the phone and yell and scream because everybody agreed. They said, oh, yeah, we know that. So it's really a myth that somehow has gotten out there and gets propagated that if you have lumpy breasts, you're more likely to get cancer and that, therefore, if you treat lumpy breasts, you can prevent cancer, neither of which is true.
What's the latest on the breast cancer gene?
The breast cancer gene, well, one of them, because it's probably going to be more than one, was identified last fall. And the gene that was identified is for breast and ovarian cancer. So it's families where the grandmother had ovarian and the mother had breast and two aunts had ovarian and, you know, your sister had breast cancer. It's that kind of a family. And we're at least have I cloned the gene for that. We don't yet have a blood test for it, so we can't test for it yet. It's going to be more than one gene. All cancer is genetic. It's all genes that get screwed up. Sometimes you inherit the screwed up gene, and sometimes you acquire the screwed up gene by exposure to carcinogens or something in the environment or pesticides or whatever. So this gene is one that's inherited. But in most cases of breast cancer, the genes aren't inherited. Only 5% of breast cancer is hereditary, is really inherited. So the gene will be important, the blood test will be important, but only for a very limited number of women. And, you know, the big worry, too, is at least if healthcare stays the way it is, if you test positive for this gene, you'll never get health insurance again in this country.
As a doctor, what are you hoping that the gene will eventually tell us and help us prevent or help us do?
Well, it's the first step to figuring out what are the genetic steps that cause breast cancer. What are the screwed up genes that are going to lead to breast cancer? And if we can figure out what those are, then we have the potential for fixing them. Either fixing the broken gene or replacing whatever it is that the broken gene is supposed to do. Let's say it's supposed to make a certain protein, then we could give you that protein. So by figuring out the really basis of breast cancer, what the genes are, will really open the doors for us to be able to figure out much more subtle ways of treating it or preventing it.
Dr. Susan Love is my guest, and there's a new edition of her book, Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book. What do you recommend to your patients about how often they should get mammograms?
Well, I think that there's no controversy, and everyone agrees that mammography in women over 50 works great. And so every woman over 50 should be getting regular mammograms every 2 years or every year. Below 50 is much more tricky because with all the studies that have been done, we still haven't been able to show a difference in mortality of breast cancer in women who get mammograms under 50. And so right now, the American Cancer Society is saying, yes, we should still do it under 50, and the National Cancer Institute is saying, no, maybe we shouldn't. I think that women at 40 should get one mammogram and see what their breasts look like. One of the problems with mammography in younger women is that the breast tissue is dense and that cancer doesn't show up so well against dense breast tissue. And so as you get older, and particularly once you go through menopause, the dense breast tissue starts to fade away, it gets replaced by fat, and cancer shows up great against fat. So one of the reasons mammography works better over 50 is because the breast tissue is less dense. Some young women have, you know, fatty breasts even though they're under 50, and so you can do a mammogram at 40, see what your breasts look like, see whether it's going to be worth it for you, weigh the risks and benefits in your case if you have a family history or other risk factors, and make your own decision about whether it's worth it for you in that earlier decade. I wouldn't start before 40.
What about the risk from radiation?
Well, radiation definitely causes cancer, but it's interesting because it's low-dose radiation, and it's particularly depends when you get it, at least for breast cancer. So it seems like radiation in the, quote, immature breast around puberty, even in infancy or childhood, will increase the risk more than radiation later. So girls who had scoliosis and had x-rays of their back once a week to see whether it was straight or not when they were in puberty, they have more breast cancer. At one point, we were treating acne of the chest with radiation back in the 50s. They have more breast cancer. People who had tuberculosis, again, as teenagers, and they kept checking on their lungs with fluoroscopy, they have more breast cancer. So there's something about radiation in the young, immature breast tissue, which is, in fact, quite dangerous. And then later on, it's less dangerous. Once the tissue is more, quote, mature, it's less sensitive.
I keep reading different things about when lumpectomy and when mastectomy are called for, and I wonder what your latest thinking on that is, when you recommend one over the other?
Well, I think that most of the time, lumpectomy and radiation is a procedure of choice. And the only time, in fact, when we do a mastectomy is when the lump is so big and the breast is so small that you can't do a lumpectomy. So it's really size of the tumor and size of the breast. We have this erroneous notion that if you cut the breast off, cancer won't come back again. And in fact, the recurrence rate after mastectomy in the scar is about 8 to 10%. And the recurrence rate in the breast after lumpectomy and radiation is about 8 to 10%. So it's exactly the same. And mastectomy doesn't give you any advantage as far as having the cancer come back. So in some ways, lumpectomy and radiation is the most aggressive because you can radiate a bigger area than I as a surgeon can cut out. So lumpectomy and radiation is probably the first choice. I think it's the first choice anyway. And only when I can't do it because the lump is too big do we do a mastectomy.
Some women are so afraid that they're at a high risk for breast cancer that they have preventive mastectomies to prevent breast cancer. You write that you've done four of them during your whole career. These women must have worked really hard to persuade you to do it.
Took them a year or so of nagging, yeah. Yeah, the problem with it is that we don't get all the breast tissue when we do a mastectomy. It's not a different color. It doesn't look different. In fact, I hate to say it all looks like chicken fat in there. We think we're very sexy, but we're not that different than chickens. And we get some of the breast tissue, but not all of it. You know, the ducts themselves, milk ducts, go up as high as the collarbone and down to the ribs. If you just, anybody who's breastfed and thinks about what happened when their milk came in and how big their breast suddenly became and how extensively it swelled up, you realize how much breast tissue is really there compared to what we see otherwise. And so we never get it all out. And removing 95% of the tissue does not remove 95% of the risk. It may remove some of the risk. We don't know. Nobody's really studied it. In animals, it doesn't remove any of the risk. I mean, they've actually done studies on rats who have 12 breasts, and they remove 3 or 6 or 9 or 12 of their breasts, and then they give them a carcinogen. They get the same number of cancers as if no matter how much breast tissue you've removed. So the answer is probably not trying to remove the breast tissue. It's figuring out some way of prevention that is systemic, that will get to all the tissue, and that really will prevent the disease.
Dr. Susan Love is my guest, and there's a new edition of her book, Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Susan Love, there's a new edition of her breast book that's just been published. There's a relatively new treatment for breast cancer that uses very high doses of chemotherapy and removes either bone marrow or blood cells. I'd like you to explain the basic premise of that procedure.
Well, we've been using chemotherapy. Oh, I should back up a minute and say one of the problems in breast cancer and one of the things we've realized in the last decade is that it's been there a long time and that cancer cells get out into the rest of the body well before we get on the scene. And so that's why mastectomy doesn't work or lumpectomy and radiation, because those cells are already in other more important organs, lungs, liver, bones. And that's what really kills people from breast cancer. So we started using chemotherapy. Drugs get into the bloodstream, circulate around, find those cells, blast the hell out of them. The problem is even that doesn't work that well. And there were still a lot of women who would get chemotherapy and would still die of breast cancer. So people said, aha, maybe it's because we're not giving enough chemotherapy. Now, the limiting factor was how much the bone marrow, which makes your red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets, could tolerate, because chemotherapy is indiscriminate. It interferes with any dividing cells, not just cancer. So they said, what we'll do is we'll take the bone marrow out, we'll stick it in the freezer, we'll blast the hell out of you with very high doses of chemo, and then we'll get your bone marrow out of the freezer and give it back to you. So it's a different kind of bone marrow transplant than is used for some of the bone marrow cancers, where you get somebody else's bone marrow. This is just a way of protecting your bone marrow so you can have super high doses of chemo. And now we've got it refined so that you don't even have to do the bone marrow. You can actually take some of the bone marrow cells out of the bloodstream and do it. But the problem is we have, as of yet, not proven that more chemotherapy is better, that the studies are going on right now, and it may or may not be that the problem was how much dose we gave. It may be that it has to do with the fact that we don't have the right drugs, or that chemotherapy itself is maybe not the right answer. We know that the radical mastectomy didn't work any better than lumpectomy and radiation. And so it's not necessarily true that just because it's higher doses, it's going to work better.
While you're going through the bone marrow transplant, I think it's just really horrible. You basically lose your immune system for weeks.
That's right.
And you become prone to many different kinds of severe opportunistic infections. What advice do you give women about whether the payoffs are worth the risks?
Well, I think this is something every woman has to weigh for herself, and it depends very much on where her head is, whether she is a risk taker or not, whether she wants to gamble on something which may have a big payoff and may not. And I think that it's important that women get realistic information about it. I think sometimes in our enthusiasm to try new things as physicians, we oversell things. We say, well, you know, your risk of dying is 50% or 60% from this cancer, and chemotherapy will improve that a bit, but maybe if you do this transplant, you'll be even better. And it's very hard for someone to turn that down. But I think women need to realize that this is still experimental, that the data is really not out yet on how effective this is, and that it's there's always a risk. You know, there's no free lunch, and so you're always gambling one thing for another.
You've described the standard therapy for breast cancer as slash, poison, and burn.
That's right.
Very unpleasant. And yet, that's all you have. Those are the only tools you have to work with right now.
That's right, and that's what I do. I mean, I once got a complaint by after I had said that in a medical journal, saying, we in the trenches are working very hard, and how dare you call it slash, burn, and poison. I said, listen, I'm in the trenches. I operate on breast cancer. I do all of this stuff. It's just that it's a very crude way to deal with disease. And if we really understood breast cancer, we would not be dealing with it this crudely. And my hope is that as we start to understand the molecular biology, we'll get to much more subtle treatments that will work a lot better.
Give me an idea of what your dream is of a treatment that might happen in your lifetime.
Well, I think, first of all, we'll figure out how to prevent breast cancer in my lifetime. Whether it's fixing the gene, whether it's replacing the abnormal protein, whether it's identifying what the carcinogen is so that we can eliminate it, I'm sure that we'll have a way of preventing it, and then we won't have to deal with any of this stuff. But in terms of treatment, it's actually, there are a lot of steps, you know, for breast cancer, or any cancer, to spread. First, it has to grow inside the milk duct. Then it has to develop the ability to get out of the milk duct. Then it has to sort of make new blood vessels grow in to feed it. Then it has to be able to crawl over to the new blood vessel and break into the blood vessel and survive in the bloodstream with all the immune system trying to get it. And then it has to be able to get out in another organ and make more new blood vessels grow in. All of these steps can be interfered with. Right now, there are trials going on to see with anti-angiogenesis drugs, drugs that block the growth of new blood vessels. If you do that, then the cancer can't grow. If you block the ability of the cancer to survive in the bloodstream, then it can't survive. Or even better, I mean, this is one of my big fantasies. There are cases of patients who have had breast cancer, have been fully treated, and do fine for 10 years, 15 years, and then the cancer comes back again. What were those cells doing for 10 or 15 years? They were asleep. What put them to sleep? If they can be asleep for 15 years, why not can't they be asleep for 30 years or 40 years? So if we could figure out how to do that, we wouldn't have to kill them. We wouldn't have to slash, burn, and poison. We'd just put them all to sleep.
Do you have any hypotheses about the causes of breast cancer?
Well, as I said earlier, all cancer is genetic. It's all genes that are screwed up. And I think that the question is what screws them up? Right now, we're looking at a lot of things in the environment. Pesticides is one hot topic right now, and we know that pesticides, a lot of them are metabolized like estrogen, like DDT is metabolized as estrogen. And so people are wondering whether that relates to breast cancer. Diet is another one. Not just fat in the diet, which is sort of being questioned, but things like soy protein and plant estrogens that may be protective that we don't have as much in our diet right now. We know that exercise more than 3 times a week actually decreases breast cancer by about 40%, and that's also hormonal. And I can't help but think that right now, when we use so many hormones in women through the pill, through fertility drugs, through postmenopausal hormones, that adding all this hormones to our bodies is probably not good as far as breast cancer is concerned.
Dr. Susan Love. She has a new edition of her book, which is called Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, world music critic Milo Miles tells us about a new anthology of Arab pop music. It includes the selection we're listening to now. And nature writer Cy Montgomery tells us about the man-eating tigers of Bengal. They can swim, they can leap 25 feet to get to their prey. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Senator John McCain says Secretary of State Warren Christopher is recommending formal diplomatic ties with Vietnam. The Arizona Republican says that's the information he's gotten from State Department officials. McCain is a former prisoner of war in Vietnam. He said repeatedly that it's time for the two former enemies to normalize relations. President Clinton is going to speak to the nation tonight about the budget deficit. Aides say he believes the budget can be balanced within 10 years, UPI's Bill Small reports.
Spokesman Mike McCurry says Mr. Clinton considers tonight's speech a good opportunity to frame the current budget debate, to influence House and Senate conferees attempting to reconcile budget differences, and perhaps avoid a summer of legislative gridlock and numerous presidential vetoes.
This will take the shape of a fairly comprehensive set of guidelines that can include specific recommendations to the Congress on how they could adjust the current budget resolution to meet the priorities suggested by the President.
In his 5-minute Oval Office address, Mr. Clinton will describe a plan to reach a balanced budget in 10 years, but let his aides flesh out the details. Bill Small at the White House.
FBI documents obtained by two Detroit newspapers say Michigan farmer James Nichols talked about blowing up the Oklahoma Federal Building 7 years ago. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
James Nichols is the brother of Oklahoma bombing suspect Terry Nichols. It was at James' farm in Decker, Michigan, that Terry and Timothy McVeigh both lived for a time. James Nichols is not a suspect in the Oklahoma case, but faces separate charges for making explosives on his farm. The Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News, using the Freedom of Information Act, have obtained a previously withheld federal affidavit related to the James Nichols case. The document quotes an unidentified informant who says during a conversation in 1988, not long after a terrorist bomb destroyed a Pan Am flight over Lockerbie, Scotland, Nichols spoke of building a mega bomb. And according to the informant, Nichols specifically mentioned the Oklahoma Federal Building, even drawing a sketch of the building. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A North Korean official says there are still a few blocks to hurdle in nuclear talks with the United States. Negotiators for both countries announced a provisional agreement to implement last year's nuclear accord. A joint statement says the countries have agreed to replace North Korea's aging nuclear reactors with new ones designed by the United States. The old reactors produce a lot of bomb-grade plutonium. The wording of today's agreement satisfies the North because it doesn't say that the new reactors will come from South Korea. One U.S. negotiator says it's still where the reactors will come from anyway. On Wall Street, in unofficial results, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 38 points to end the day at 4,484. Advances led decliners in heavy trading. This is NPR. The United States says it's satisfied with the results of auto talks held with Japan. A U.S. official told the Associated Press that Japan was apparently satisfied with the outcome as well, but Japanese officials had earlier complained of disagreements on, quote, important basic points. Both sides met for 7 hours yesterday, but repeated their long-standing positions afterwards. No further meetings are planned. The U.S. is planning to impose 100% tariffs on 13 brands of Japanese luxury cars unless Japan opens its car market to imports. A coalition of consumer groups has lashed out at Republican Senator Bob Dole for his proposed regulatory reforms. Activists say Dole's bill would derail Agriculture Department plans to improve the safety of the meat supply and make it easier for industry to block new regulations. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
Dole's proposal would require government agencies to do a cost-benefit analysis of new environmental, health, or safety regulations. Consumer groups say the measure would delay or kill an Agriculture Department plan to modernize inspections at meat and poultry plants. Activists say food poisoning from meat and poultry causes 5 million illnesses each year and kills 4,000 people. Carol Tucker Foreman is with the Safe Food Coalition.
No one has a right to sell filthy meat and poultry to the American people. And there are no Americans who went to the polls last November and voted in favor of dirty meat.
Supporters of regulatory reform charge critics are grossly exaggerating the threat. They say layers of regulation are stifling American business. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
The government has released good news about inflation. Prices at the consumer level rose 0.3% last month. Analysts say this shows that inflation is under control. The increase was led by a big jump in energy prices during May. Some economists say the report is likely to support arguments a cut in short-term interest rates is looming. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. So seldom do we Westerners think of our own flesh as meat, writes my guest Cy Montgomery. But she was a potential meal while she studied the man-eating tigers of Sundarban, a forest between India and Bangladesh. She says wherever tigers are found, they evoke reverence and fear. But the tigers of Sundarban are the only tigers that are known to eat people. In her new book, Spell of the Tiger, Montgomery writes about the animals and the beliefs that surround them. Her previous book was about the great apes and the primatologists who study them. Montgomery told me that the people of Sundarban revere the man-eating tigers and attribute several magical powers to them.
First, they can fly through the air. I was told this again and again, that the tiger flies through the air, that it becomes invisible. They say that the tigers can leap onto your boat out of the water and that you won't feel the boat rock when this 400 to 500 pound animal lands there, that you won't hear a sound. And that the first sign you have that a tiger has come on board and killed a person in your group is that you'll hear the splash when the tiger dives overboard again with the man in his mouth.
How did you decide to study these tigers?
Well, I write about people's relationship with animals. This is something that it seems we need to know more about. Particularly here in the West, we seem to have a paucity of relationships possible between us and other beings. It seems like our relationship usually consists of we slaughter them and they die. There must be, I've thought, other ways to relate to animals. And I was very interested in relationships between people and predators, relationships that worked, relationships that helped us see the world as whole with both people and predators in it. And that's what led me to look at tigers and ultimately led me to Sundarban.
Did you come across a lot of people in Sundarban who had been attacked by tigers who had relatives or friends who were killed by tigers?
Many, many people had eyewitness accounts of family members and friends who were killed by tigers. I was amazed at how frequently this happened. In fact, between my first and second trips over there, in the space of 3 weeks that I went home to celebrate Christmas, one of the people I had met in December had been eaten by the time I returned in January. There's entire villages over there that are tiger widow villages made up entirely of people who have lost a father, a son, a husband, or an uncle to tiger attack.
Would you share one of the stories with us that you heard about a tiger attack?
Oh, certainly. There's so many of them. One of the more chilling stories was told to me by a fellow in Bangladesh. And he told me that he was sitting on his boat with several companions in the evening. And he was talking to his companion, and he just turned aside for a moment. And when he turned back to resume speaking with his companion, the man was gone. And then he heard the splash. And everyone flashed their torches on the riverbank, and there they saw in the beam of light this great, huge, wet cat emerging from the river. carrying the person in its jaws, and then it disappeared into the forest.
No, it almost sounds improbable, you know, that it could happen so quickly that there you wouldn't hear when the tiger came.
Yeah, so many of the things that you hear people tell you, and they tell you this in good faith, too. There's no reason for them to try to lie to you about this. And many folks who tend to look at things in a more scientific way would say, well, you know, this is impossible. Tigers can't fly through the air. You know, tigers can't disappear and become invisible. But it turns out a lot of the things that the people told me were factually true, but not in the way that we would initially think of it.
What do you mean?
Flying through the air. Tigers can't fly through the air like Tinkerbell, but they can leap for 25 feet. As far as disappearing into thin air, becoming invisible, tigers don't get see-through all of a sudden, but you can even go to the zoo and watch a tiger in an exhibit, and that tiger really can become invisible behind a blade of grass. I've gone through a lot of zoos as part of promoting this book, and frequently you'll see a whole truckload of tourists going past the tiger exhibit, and the person whose job it is to explain all the animals in the different exhibit will say, oh, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, the tiger isn't on display today. And the tiger is right there, but no one can see it. They really can become invisible, but not the way we might initially expect. So the stories are important for that reason, and that often they really are excellent natural history observations.
My guest is Sai Montgomery. She's written a new book called Spell of the Tiger. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sai Montgomery. Her new book, Spell of the Tiger, is about man-eating tigers in the forest between India and Bangladesh. Now, how do people in Sundarban try to protect themselves against tiger attacks?
Well, this is what really drew me to Sundarban. The people there don't have guns, and even if they did, it's doubtful that they would use this to protect themselves for a number of reasons. They don't want to eradicate the tiger, even though hundreds of them are killed every year. What they do to protect themselves range from these wonderful face masks that are worn on the back of the neck. This was an idea that was conceived by a person who was a member of a science club in Calcutta. And he remarked the well-known fact that tigers prefer to attack from behind. They don't like to attack from the front. So people began wearing these little plastic face masks that the Forest Department provided for them on the back of their heads. The idea was that the tiger couldn't find which was the real front. And in fact, for several years, tigers would sometimes follow people wearing these things, and they would sometimes growl with annoyance. But they did not attack people wearing these masks.
Now, let me stop you here. You know, you say in your book that tigers even don't eat the face, that tigers don't like to look at the face of a victim.
Yes, wasn't that amazing? I was astonished to find these references. It's so well embedded in our tiger lore that they don't like our faces, they don't like our heads. I even read one account in which it appears a tiger chewed the head off a person. It was actually a person with leprosy, so that the annoying head would then roll downhill and he wouldn't have to look at the thing. They really don't like our faces or our heads. They don't like looking at our open eyes staring at them.
So people started wearing face masks on the back of their head to fool the tigers, and were they effective?
They know this worked for several years. The odd thing is that when I went back, the only time in my three trips that I could ever find a single party who carried the masks with them was the third trip. And this suggests that the people don't believe they work anymore. But then, you know, the same is true of seatbelts. Americans, we know seatbelts work, but unless there's a law, we just don't tend to wear them.
What else do people do to try to prevent tiger attacks?
The Forest Department has come up with these ingenious clay dummies, which are fashioned to look just like regular woodcutters and fishermen. They dress them in clothes that people have worn so that the dummies smell like us. They put them in the forest, and around the neck of the dummy, they circle some galvanized steel wire, and this is hooked up to a car battery. And the tigers will attack these dummies. But when they do, they literally get the shock of their lives, and forest workers have heard the tigers screaming in pain and possibly in anger when this happens. And the tiger is supposed to learn from this experience not to attack people anymore. But no one really knows what lesson the tiger takes away from this experience. The main thing that people rely upon to protect themselves from these tigers is prayer.
The people in the Shundabun pray to the tiger god, Dachshund Roy. Who is the tiger god? Tell us something about him.
According to their old, old legends, which may predate Hinduism, it was Dachshund Roy, the tiger god, who originally owned all the riches of Shundabun, all the fishes and all the timber and all the bee combs and all the land. And that to this day, they believe he protects this land against intruders, and that to gain entry to his territory, you must enter with great reverence. And most people, when they go into Shundabun in a group to either fish or cut wood or gather honey, if they can afford it, they take with them a priest of sorts, who, if he's Hindu, they call a gunin. If he's Muslim, he's a fakir. And they will take this holy man with them so that he can pronounce the special words of mantras of prayers, that he can cast a spell that makes the place safe for them to work, and that he can convey to the tiger god their sincerity and their humility as they approach his land.
Well, you write in your book that even the forest department in India won't send in timber cutters without a shaman to honor the tiger god.
That is so. And in fact, the biggest worship service which is held for the tiger god and the forest goddess is financed and put on by the forest department itself.
Even though the tiger is a threat to the people in Shundabun don't want to kill off the tiger. At least that's the impression you were left with.
That's absolutely true. They realize that if they kill off the tiger, the guardian of their world will have been slain.
How is the tiger the guardian of their world?
Well, Shundabun exists at the confluence of two miracles, really. One is that here between India and Bangladesh, in this 10,000 square kilometer tract, is the largest mangrove forest left on the face of the earth. How can this be left here between two of the most overpopulated countries on the globe, this enormous mangrove swamp? And the other miracle is that here are more tigers than anywhere else on earth. How can this be? Well, it can be because the tigers there are so aggressive. The reason that that mangrove forest has not been cut down is because it's being protected by 500 hungry man-eating tigers. That is the only reason that people have not gone in there and cut down that whole forest.
If the tiger were the only thing standing in the way of developing that part of the forest, wouldn't there be developers with plenty of high-tech weapons willing to take their chances?
Well, it would be very difficult to wipe out those tigers. Interestingly, although elsewhere, as you know, tigers are highly endangered and might even disappear from the wild in 10 years, in Shundabun, it is so hard to even see them that people do not hunt them. there's a great incentive to hunt tigers elsewhere because their body parts are used to make all kinds of potions and elixirs for which people will pay huge amounts of money. But in Shundaban, there are no poachers of that kind. You can't hunt out the tigers there because they're going to get you first. And there's a number of other impediments to development. It's a very dangerous track. There's no roads there, only waterways. There's cyclonic storms. There's man-eating crocodiles. There's, I think, 9 different kinds of very aggressive sharks. The water is bad to drink. There's many, many reasons why people haven't gone in there. But top of the list is these 500 tigers out there ready to eat you.
Cy Montgomery is the author of the new book, Spell of the Tiger. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, President Clinton is scheduled to address the nation tonight.
Hi, Terry. Yes, indeed. A short speech that Mara Liasson tells us would lay out a way to cut back the growth of Medicaid and Medicare. Other stories, Margot Adler reports on 2 professional musicians. They're suing the Internal Revenue Service. The question is how much they can depreciate the value of their very expensive violins that they use in their profession. Also, NPR's Howard Berkus reports on the hopes of Salt Lake City to win the competition to host the Winter Olympic Games in 2002, the poetry of Lucille Clifton, and a computer privacy case involving the Internet and the Church of Scientology.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Occasionally, a particular style of world music may break through in America with an off-the-wall hit. A much more reliable method of audience building is to begin the process with a well-programmed sampler. Music critic Milo Miles says that until now, no strong anthology of modern Arabic pop was readily available. Here's Milo's review of Sif Safa, new music from the Middle East.
At first, it may not seem like Arabic pop is such a closed world to Western ears. After all, Rai from Algeria and Gnawa from Morocco have gotten a healthy dose of both press coverage and record releases in the past few years. But Rai and Gnawa are rather local phenomena compared with Egyptian pop, which developed in the 1920s and dominates Egypt and the Gulf states to this day. With the collection Sif Safa, compiler Gerald Seligman concentrates on performers who keep the roots intact even as they branch out a bit, and he makes the song sequence plenty listenable. It's the Arab music anthology to get.
ملك أمل في قربها لو يوم أبعد وجن ضربها هذا هو المكسب قلت اتركوني واسكتوا خلوا العتب واللوم قدني غرقت في بحرها العالي في دلعوم
Proto violins originated in the Middle East. The particular kind of string section you heard on that cut by Hamdi Ahmed became standard in Egyptian pop through the work of the immensely popular woman singer Kulthum. In the 40s and 50s, entire countries took a break to listen to her live radio broadcasts. I generally wouldn't want to touch a string section with a 10-foot bow, but Arabic ones are different. They're angular, astringent, part and parcel of the polyrhythms and drones they accompany. The sound is large, but not lush. However, not all the cuts on Sif Safai emphasize strings. One of the most striking includes almost no instruments at all.
Nami, nami, ya sghira, yalla ghfiha al-hasira. Nami, nami, ya sghira, yalla ghfiha al-hasira. نامي في حضن ايديا بكرة شمسي جاية هتدفينا بحب كبير وتلملم كل الجيرة نامي نامي يا صغيرة يلا
Perhaps I've been swayed by devotion to Kulthum, but the women vocalists on Sif Safa sound more expressive to me. They sound like sirens of romantic loss and social anxiety compared to the men, who often suggest mere experts at a rather literary song tradition. Whether the performers come from Egypt, Saudi Arabia, or Iraq, the infusion of Western instruments like synthesizers and guitars has actually bolstered and focused Arab music instead of corrupting it, at least where the Western sounds have been assimilated without imitating Western forms. There's a certain purposeful drive and compression to modern Egyptian-style pop that plainly distinguishes it from the very leisurely, not to say rambling, song epics from 30 and 40 years ago. Sif Safa is catchy without being compromised, done by savvy musicians who know they need to know what time it is, but don't need to run by a digital quartz watch.
Milo Miles is a music critic living in Cambridge. He reviewed Sif Safa on the EMI Hemisphere series, distributed by IRS Records. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
هتروح من قلبي فين قلبي شوفك لو فين
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Farrer, Straus & Giroux, publisher of The Coming Plague, Laurie Garrett's book about the outbreak of infectious diseases from Ebola to AIDS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Ringo, and I play the drums.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Ringo and talk about his life before, during, and after the Beatles. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.